Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Elspeth Hay. She's a writer and creator and host of the Local Food Report, and she reports and writes about food and the environment. We're going to be talking about her new book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. Elspeth, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a fascinating book, and there's a lot of issues besides the title of the book that you deal with in this book. But let's start with acorns. This is essentially a deep dive into cultivating nuts, and it starts with, and it's funny to say starts with acorns because it's sort of a symbol of things beginning. But how did acorns inspire this quest of yours?
Well, I have been reporting on food and the environment for almost 15 years, and I live in the middle of a giant oak forest, and I had never heard anyone mention eating acorns. And then a friend emailed me a TEDx talk by a woman named Marcy Mayer, who's an expat, American expat living in Greece. And she said that acorns are edible, and not only are they edible, but they're actually one of humans' oldest staple foods and a superfood. And so that caught my attention, and I reached out to her. And that was sort of the beginning of a long journey of learning about this forgotten food.
And you traveled around, too. I want to mention that for the people who are listening. You visit a lot of other things. Now, what did you find out about acorns? And I want to mention, back when I was a hippie in the 1970s, there was a famous book called Stalking the Wild Asparagus by Yule Gibbons. And in that was the recipe for making acorns, acorns glacé, as a matter of fact, which I actually tried.
Yeah, there is, you know, a lot of people used to know that we can eat acorns, and it's really only recently, I mean, depending on where you are, the timeline is a little different, but it's a fairly recent loss of knowledge that most people today don't know that you can eat acorns. I did spend some time when I was researching the book with a man named Ron Reed, who's mm-hmm. a member of the Karuk tribe in Northern California. And his people have eaten acorns as a staple food. So that's, you know, an everyday crop like wheat or rice or corn for thousands of years since time immemorial. And I was really surprised when I first started learning about acorns to learn that that's true not just in Northern California, but actually all over the Northern Hemisphere. Acorns have been a staple food in a huge variety of different cultures and communities.
And it's not just acorns and oaks. This book is really about a variety of tree crops, a variety of nuts, things like pecans, pistachios, and actually then other kinds of food plants and trees. And you're surprised at the fact that we aren't making more of it. We aren't doing it. We're not cultivating it, but you sought out these people who are. Why aren't we doing more with nuts?
Well, partly it has to do with the sort of land use and agricultural cycle that we're caught in right now. We're constantly operating on a really short time frame, and tree crops take years to come to maturity and start bearing. So if you're someone with a 1 or 3 year lease on a piece of land, they're not going to be a good fit for you. And a lot of land tenure for farmers has become very insecure and year to year. So when we're talking about, you know, I interviewed one group of chestnut growers in Iowa who had just transitioned the family farm, and they did have secure land tenure, and they were sort of tired of this short rotation cropping system that was, you know, wreaking havoc on soil fertility. And they were able to put in trees, but those trees take 15 years to come to full maturity.
Oh,
and then,
yeah.
Of course, you know, they can live for hundreds of years. So if we're able to get over that initial hump, then we have something that's really low input in terms of money and labor for a long time. But, you know, we're trapped sort of in, a lot of farmers are trapped in a system where it's hard for them to get over that hump.
What are the kinds of tree crops did you discover could be used? Right now I'm eating pecans as we're speaking and cashews.
Yeah.
But there was a whole, it wasn't just acorns. It was a whole variety of tree crops that you discovered that people could use.
Yeah, so when we're looking at our forests, what's really interesting about these nut trees is that a lot of them are what's called a keystone species. So that's a species that's as important to its ecosystem as a keystone in the in a Roman arch, right? So you pull that keystone out, the whole thing falls apart. So oaks are a big keystone species, chestnuts, hazelnuts, walnuts, a lot of these nut species, pecans. It depends on the ecosystem you're in, but when you look at some of these top ecosystem life support species, oftentimes nuts are in that top 20. And a lot of cultures knew this. You know, a lot of cultures historically called these trees the tree of life. Oaks, hazelnuts, chestnuts were really important. I interviewed people in one community in Switzerland where they've been eating chestnuts as a staple food for thousands of years. And they, historically, the average person was eating about 330 pounds of chestnuts per year, which I actually ended up, I saw that statistic, and I ended up looking up American grain consumption, and it's only 150 pounds of grains per person per year. So that is just a stunning amount of chestnut consumption.
Now, for the benefit of the audience, they're not just eating chestnuts, like cracking the nut open and then eating it. They're also turning it into other different kinds of forms, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're making chestnut gnocchi, chestnut pasta, chestnut flour that they're baking with. They're boiling dried chestnuts and turning them almost into this, like, mashed potato dish. There's a huge variety of dishes they make. I actually was just over there for a chestnut festival and got to sample some. And you could eat chestnuts for days and have them all different ways.
Now, what are the advantages of tree crops versus grain crops?
Yeah, so something that I think a lot of us sort of know about the way that we practice agriculture now, but maybe don't know the details, is that every time we plow up a field, we are emitting greenhouse gases into the air. So plants store carbon in the soil. Every time that soil gets disturbed, that carbon goes back into the atmosphere. What happens with tree crops is these really long-lived species are storing carbon in the soil, and that's just getting more and more and more built up year after year after year. So there's a pretty big difference in terms of the soil fertility and the climate effect of these farming practices. And another thing is that with row crops, we tend to plant a lot of monocultures.
Well, these corporate farms are just like all one thing.
Yeah, and you know that's very different from smaller regional or local farms. When I'm talking about these row crops, I'm really talking about what you see in the Midwest in these really industrial landscapes. I've had people say, "So you're against wheat?" I'm not against wheat. You know, there's a time and a place for everything. But when we focus only on corn and soy to the detriment of our ecosystems, what's really interesting that I've seen a lot of tree crop farmers doing is polyculture. So they aren't just having one species. You know, if you look out in an oak forest, it's not an oak monoculture, right? Where I am, I'm looking out the window right now, there's pines mixed in, there's hazelnuts mixed in, there's huckleberries, blueberries, and a lot of these species have co-evolved. So what is exciting to see is that there are farmers now, especially in the Midwest, who are tired of our current system and who are actually planting farms to mimic these natural tree nut ecosystems. So they're planting a diversity of plants and producing an abundance of food while kind of restoring this degraded farmland.
One of the nuts you mentioned, and you write about this a lot in your book, is the American chestnut. And for the benefit of the audience and people who don't know, what happened to the American chestnut tree?
Yeah, so
that used to be all over. It used to be one of the most common trees that you would see.
Yeah, they used to be a really, really important tree in our forests, especially in eastern North America. And what happened is a fungal blight that had co-evolved with Asian chestnuts came over on some imported nursery stock. And it started spreading. You know, fungus is, it spreads on spores. It can be wind dispersed. So the fungus started spreading. It moved really quickly. That started in the early 1900s. By the 1940s, there were an estimated 4 billion American chestnut trees in eastern North America, and today the species is functionally extinct. So it happened really fast. There are a lot of different efforts underway to bring an American-type tree back, and I spent a lot of time talking with different people about the different methods they're using, because there are kind of pros and cons to different forms of breeding. But what's interesting is that chestnuts used to be a really common food. You know, even when my grandparents were alive, they were a very common food. And we've largely forgotten about them. Even though we can grow blight-resistant trees, there's nothing stopping us from a farming perspective from growing chestnuts. And some farmers have realized that, and there's a growing number of farmers in the Northeast and the Midwest who are really trying to bring this crop back.
And what about the Asiatic chestnut? Wasn't there an attempt to try to introduce that?
Yeah, so in a lot of places where the blight really devastated communities, especially in mountainous areas in Appalachia.
In the Appalachians, you visit that area, and there were whole communities that were dependent upon chestnuts.
Yeah, whole subsistence communities where wasn't just people eating chestnuts, but also their farm and game animals that they depended on for meat were also chestnut fed. So there was a huge collapse, and it happened around the time of the Great Depression.
Yeah.
So kind of a double whammy in that area. And the Park Service actually did plant some Chinese chestnuts in some areas. But what happens with that species is the American chestnut was as tall as other trees in the forest, and so it could compete in these kind of wilder areas. And, you know, didn't have to be managed necessarily. The Chinese chestnut doesn't get as tall. It's more of an orchard-type tree. And so I think that it needed a different kind of care that people weren't used to. And I also think that there was so much grief in the wake of that trauma that people kind of weren't ready for this new tree to take the place of the American chestnut.
I know. It was fascinating in your book. You interviewed older people who actually remember the chestnut trees or the chestnut trees dying off and what it did to their communities. I mean, essentially, it just killed them off.
Yeah, I mean, the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is a national park, part of the reason the government was able to acquire that land was because so many people had just left. They had to abandon their community because they didn't have a way to feed their families anymore.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Elspeth Hay. She's a writer and creator and host of the Local Food Report, and she reports and writes about food and the environment. And her new book is Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. Another big issue you really got off on was the question of yield. When anybody starts talking about nut crops versus grain crops, the whole story about yield comes up. What did you find out about that?
Basically, I found out that most conversations that we have about yield are, if you put it nicely, inaccurate. If you put it the other way, they're lies. They're not accurate at all. I talked with a really interesting agronomist, Ricardo Salvador, who pointed out to me that yield is a ratio, right? So you're measuring, there's a numerator and a denominator, and you're measuring what you're getting out for what you're putting in. And we normally only talk about what we're getting off of a piece of land. So, you know, when we talk about these really high corn or soy yields, we're just talking about the land where we're growing the crop. We're not talking about all the land it took to produce all the inputs to grow the crop. But when we're looking at feeding the world, which we like to talk about a lot, you know, all the land is the limiting factor, not just the land where you're actually growing the food. It's, you know, the land that it took to get the fossil fuels, the land that it took to produce the fertilizer, and on and on and on. And when we look at those numbers, these tree crops, and especially polyculture crops, are much more efficient. They have higher yields when we're looking at all the land involved. And they're actually one of our most efficient ways of feeding ourselves. So, yeah, I did go really, really deep down the yield rabbit hole because I had heard my whole life that, you know, we have to farm the way that we do because American grains are feeding the world. And it's just not accurate at all. You know, if you look even just at American corn, which covers a huge area of our country, I think it's the size of Texas, the area that we plant corn on. I think about 40% of that is for ethanol. Another 40% is for feeding that to animals, which would do better on pasture and other forms of land management. And then almost 15% gets exported to other countries where it depresses local agricultural economies and wreaks havoc on their agricultural world. And then less than 1% is eaten by human bodies in America. So the idea that this grain is feeding the world is really not the full picture and doesn't accurately answer our questions about yield.
But what about harvesting nuts, for instance? Seems like it's very labor intensive. And is there, would there ever be enough nuts in order to feed, say, the American population in the same way that cereal crops do?
I think yes. I mean, if you, harvesting nuts is labor intensive, and so is harvesting grain. I think most of us haven't spent much time harvesting grain, but just because we're buying flour at the grocery store doesn't mean that flour is what's coming off of a plant. We have all these ancient words, right? Winnowing and threshing, and there's a lot of work involved in that too.
Well, William, there are all these machines that harvest the grain. Are there machines that harvest the nut crops?
There actually are. You know, I was just in Switzerland. They have these vacuum harvesters for chestnuts. There are, you know, we haven't dumped as much money into nut harvesting equipment. However, it's just as, you know, it's in development, and a lot of it is pretty readily available. In Turkey, for instance, there's a huge hazelnut industry. A lot of that is mechanized. So it's definitely very possible, and I think that we tend to forget that our government has invested billions and billions of dollars in our current system. It's not that grains are easier inherently or that grains are inherently more economical. It's that we have decided to focus a lot of resources on making that system efficient, and there's nothing besides our own decision-making to stop us from investing in other plants as well.
Let's talk about processing personally acorns, because you do that towards the end of the book. And now we should say acorns are edible. They're not poisonous, but there's a but.
Yeah, so acorns have the same chemical in them that olives have. So I don't know if any listeners have ever eaten an olive straight off the tree, but they are full
inedible.
Of tannins.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've done it. Okay, so they don't taste good at all. Pick an olive off the tree, it's a terrible experience. But tannins are water-soluble, so acorns also have tannins. Obviously, the tannins in olives have not stopped that from becoming a worldwide staple food, and acorns require the same type of processing to get those tannins out. So olives, it's done with either water or lye, and acorns, you can do the same processes. So you can either grind up the nuts and leach the tannins out with water, or you can add a bit of lye, and that speeds the process up.
The lye's edible?
So lye is used in a lot of traditional food processing. It might sound counterintuitive because, you know, it's caustic. It's not something you want to touch or put in your mouth in its liquid form. But when you process food with lye, the lye is in the water. So as soon as you're rinsing that water out and draining that water, traditional corn processing is also done with lye. So whenever corn gets nixtamalized, which is what needs to happen in order to free up the B vitamins. So in all, you know, South American, Central American countries where corn is a staple food, if you don't nixtamalize corn, you get a lot of vitamin deficiencies. So it's actually a really ancient technique and widely used in food processing.
Now, I've used the water technique, and it's not just you just rinse it and it's fine. The water's brown for several rinses. You've got to really do it. But as you write about, it depends also on the species of oak, right?
Yeah, it does. And as one botanist told me, oaks are promiscuous, so you might not always be sure about it. Could be a hybrid.
Damn oaks.
Yeah, but there are certain species that are much easier to get the tannins out of than others. So, for instance, in Northern California, where a lot of indigenous groups have relied on acorns as a staple food for thousands of years, there's a species of oak, tan oak, where it's much easier to get the tannins out and requires, you know, less water than, say, a northern red oak in northeastern U.S. So, yeah, it does depend on the species. I will say that I've learned a lot about processing in the past few years, and I think that it's all about having a very slow trickle of water steadily.
Yeah, you write about that in the book, yeah.
Yeah, it really speeds the process up, and I don't think it actually uses much more water. I mean, I'm talking about like a dripping trickle of water. And if you do that for a few hours, maybe a day, depending on the species, you'll get a pretty good leach right away.
Now, the indigenous communities you were talking about, and I'm going to mispronounce this, and I apologize, the Karuk?
Karuk.
Karuk. Where, talk to me about that, because that was a whole indigenous population that was nut-centered.
Yeah, so Ron Reed, who I've gotten to know, is a Karuk medicine man, indigenous biologist, and he taught me a lot about how traditionally Karuk people have tended oak forests
yeah.
to create this staple crop. And a lot of that involves prescribed fire. So at first, you know, I was surprised by that. I hadn't heard of fire on my own landscape, and I didn't know about fire as a way of taking care of oak forests. But it turns out that a lot of oak species really like the middle range of succession. So succession is that process where, like, a bare open field moves through, you know, first weeds come, then shrubs, then trees, and then you move toward a closed canopy forest. Oaks don't regenerate well in a forest with a lot of shade. They like kind of an open, mm-hmm. sunnier forest.
Yep.
And prescribed burns can help keep those conditions for species like oaks, hazelnuts, and other nuts that like that kind of middle stage, and can help keep them dominant on the landscape. And that's not just out west where we hear about these big fires, but actually also is traditional in a lot of eastern North America.
We only have a few minutes left, but I want to talk about, there are so many other deeper issues that you talk about in this book that this sort of led you to think about. One of them is the role of humanity, of humans, in the world. And to not look at humans as a problem, but as a keystone species. Can you just talk for a few minutes about that?
Yeah, it sounds like a lot to put on nut crops, right?
The poor acorn.
Yeah. As I sort of started to learn more about this connection between humans and fire and nut trees, I really started connecting the dots and realizing that across the world in a huge variety of traditional cultures, you know, in the Amazon, in Australia, in North America, in parts of Europe, humans' most important role on the landscape is to be a fire animal. So a species that's putting fire intentionally on the land to create habitat for other species. This was knowledge that was originally shared with me by Ron Reed in the context of these oak ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I learned, the more I saw that actually this was true in a huge variety of ecosystems. And that, you know, today we talk about keystone species and we usually think of humans as this really negative presence on the land. But we don't talk that way about beavers, right, or elephants. And
well,
beavers,
I think there are definitely negative impacts that we have, and that's why we're in the ecological situation we are right now.
Oh yes,
but we
sure.
could,
and, I'm not,
and certainly
I'm not
the fires out in California say those are not controlled burns; those are just out of control burns.
Yeah, no, and I think that we have, you know, we have that modern conception for a reason,
mm-hmm.
Because we are having a lot of negative impacts on the environment. But when we think of ourselves as that's just the way we are, that part isn't true. Historically,
that's not the way we have to be.
Yeah, it's not the way we have to be. Historically, we have created habitat for countless other species, and we're actually in this same sort of category of keystone species as beavers and elephants, both of which, you know, beavers create dams, they create wetlands, they create habitat for other species. They're what's called an ecosystem engineer. The same is true of elephants. They trample, they uproot, and they create habitat for other species. And historically, our job in most ecosystems has been to use fire carefully to create habitat for other species. And so one thing I was really surprised about as I researched and really excited about was this idea that through tending these keystone nut trees, we can not just feed ourselves in a way that's much less environmentally damaging, but we can actually create habitat for other wildlife and other species that kind of rely on us to keep these nut trees dominant on the landscape.
We're almost out of time, but what's your favorite nut to harvest?
I mean, I have to say acorns just because I have such a soft spot for them at this point. But a friend...
You're out in the Cape, in the upper part of the Cape.
I am, and we have a lot of white oak trees. So,
is that a good acorn species? I mean, a good oak species to harvest acorns from?
Yes, yeah. Quercus alba, the northern white oak, is a great species.
So that's you're just sort of locked into that as the favorite nut.
for now. You know, it could change.
There's also, I also want to mention, you write a lot about the commons in American history and in European history and the disappearance of the commons. That seems like that could be a topic for another book. Would you ever consider writing about that?
Yeah, I mean, I found that really interesting.
I found that when you talked about that.
Yeah, there is so much more history there, more than I was able to go into, you know, and stay on this nut focus. But yeah, for sure, there's a lot more to talk about there. And I think a lot of history that we as a country really need to grapple with on a social level. So yeah, for sure.
And I want to mention one other culture that uses acorns a lot. Korean Americans buy a lot of acorn flour.
Yes, and a lot of acorn starch, which is similar to...
Where is that grown and where is it processed?
A lot of it's in China and Korea. So yeah, it's getting shipped over here. Not a lot being made in the U.S.
Like, could you go to an Asian store here and buy acorn flour?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, acorn starch, not acorn flour. That I've seen, maybe you could also buy acorn flour, but a lot of what Korean recipes use is actually acorn starch.
If people wanted to try that out, what's the easiest thing to make with acorn starch?
So I love making an acorn pudding. You mix eggs, coconut milk, vanilla, maple syrup, and acorn starch.
Oh, wow.
A little pudding.
Okay, it's too early to hear that. My guest tonight has been Elspeth Hay. She's a writer and creator and host of Local Food Report. And she reports and writes about food and the environment. And we're talking about her new book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. Elspeth, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.